Hey guys, it's us, Chris and Robert. We just wanted to record a quick new intro to our episodes for Copycat and Suspiria, because after those episodes, we actually start sounding a lot better.
We just wanted to let you know to stick with it, and you know, the sound quality gets a lot better right afterward. And as always, if you're listening for the first time, please leave us comments. We will go back and talk about these episodes, no matter how old they are. So,
sweet dreams. Hi, I'm Chris.
Hi, I'm Robert, and we're the Film Flamers, a monthly podcast devoted to all things horror.
Well, horror and film, at least. And horror adjacent.
Horror adjacent.
Yes.
With a little sprinkle of glitter thrown in.
Today, we're actually going to be going over a film called Copycat.
A film that I think is near and dear to both of our hearts.
Yes. I think we both think it's one of the best thrillers ever made.
Quite possibly, yeah.
And a lot of people, I think, got thrown under the radar because of, a lot of other thrillers at the time. There's probably thriller fatigue. I think there was a rush after Silence of the Lambs. This came out a few years after that.
Yeah, I mean, there was a rush of crime drama and even horror movies that suffered from slasher fatigue and all the camp of the 80s. And movies like this just sort of fell under the radar, especially with some of the highbrow stuff that was coming out around the time, like Interview with the Vampire and things like that. And it wasn't quite until the later 90s when Scream came out that the horror genre really took off again in the 90s. But we had this lull point in the mid-90s where...
Yeah, it was almost like a thriller return to slasher.
Right.
You know.
We're sort of on the cusp of what we were going to see later on in the 90s, perhaps.
Sure.
Right.
Copycat is a 1995 American psychological thriller directed by John Amiel and starring Sigourney Weaver, Holly Hunter, and Dermot Mulroney. The beautiful and haunting score was composed by Christopher Young. This is Copycat.
What turns on a killer is the suffering and death of another human being. And as his determination builds to take another life, he plans in obsessive detail what props he'll bring, what knots he'll tie. Let me ask you guys something. What turns you on?
A criminal psychiatrist.
There's a serial killer out there who strangled three women. He's gonna do it again.
A homicide detective.
Would you work with us on this?
You're kidding, right?
I do not want you discussing this case with her in any shape, way, or form.
It's the Boston Strangler.
Are you telling me this guy's copycatting a serial killer's been dead for...
20 years.
You're looking for an intelligent white male, 20 to 30 years old, socially functional.
Everything's different. Different guy.
He's switched from DeSalvo to Bianchi and Buono, the Hillside Strangler.
One man is copying the most notorious killers in history. One at a time.
He's sending you letters like he's daring us to nail him.
If he wants to be famous, he has to be caught.
I'm death and life to you, Doc.
We know that Mr. Cullen was safe in San Quentin last night, so how come his book shows up under the mattress?
Together, two women must stop him.
The man who has killed five women in this city was just in your apartment.
Before he kills again.
All I know to do is change your locks, tighten up your security, and pray.
Sigourney Weaver, Holly Hunter, and Harry Connick Jr. in a deadly game of cat.
Here, kitty, kitty, kitty.
And mouse. Copycat.
Dr. Helen Hudson, played by Sigourney Weaver, is a criminal psychologist and field expert on serial killers. After giving a guest lecture at a local university, she's cornered in the restroom by one of her previous subjects, Daryl Lee Cullum, played by Harry Connick Jr. Later we learn that Cullum is a prison escapee who Helen helped put away as an expert witness in his trial. Seeking his revenge, Cullum brutally attacks her by stringing her up over the side of a restroom cubicle, nearly hanging her, and kills the police officer who was waiting outside for her protection. Unfortunately for Cullum, he was unaware of a second police officer and is caught before he can kill her. Helen becomes severely agoraphobic as a result of this attack, sealing herself inside of an expensive high-tech apartment, conducting her entire life from behind a computer screen and assisted by her gay friend Andy, played by John Rothman. 13 months later, when a new series of murders spreads fear and panic across her home city of San Francisco, Inspector M.J. Monahan, played by Holly Hunter, and her partner, Reuben Getz, played by Dermot Mulroney, solicit Helen's expertise. Initially reluctant, Helen soon finds herself drawn into a warped perpetrator's game of wits. As the murders continue, Helen realizes that the elusive assailant draws inspiration from notorious serial killers, including Albert DeSalvo, the Hillside Strangler, David Berkowitz, Jeffrey Dahmer, and Ted Bundy. When the murderer begins contacting and even stalking Helen, she and MJ realize that he's after Helen, and they enlist the aid of Colum, who, from prison, reveals he's been in contact with this new killer for some time and tells him what he knows. Helen soon realizes that the copycat killer has been following the list of serial killers in the same order as she had presented them in her lecture at the university on the night of her attack. Helen, MJ, and Reuben work to figure out where and when he'll strike next. Unfortunately, Reuben is later killed in an unrelated shooting incident at the police station, leaving MJ shaken and heartbroken to continue the search for the serial killer. After Helen's friend and assistant Andy is killed in a manner reminiscent of Jeffrey Dahmer, MJ deduces the killer to be Peter Foley, played by William McNamara. After leading a failed attempt to catch Foley at his house, MJ discovers that he's kidnapped Helen and taken her back to the scene of Daryl Lee Cullum's previous attempt at killing her, the restroom at the university lecture hall. Once MJ gets there, she finds Helen bound, hanged, and gagged in the same manner that Cullum did before. Unfortunately, MJ is ambushed and shot by Foley, rendering her unconscious. As Foley prepares to kill MJ, Helen desperately attempts to save her by ruining Foley's carefully replicated crime scene the only way she can, by attempting to hang herself. Foley panics and cuts Helen down, and she's able to get away and escape to the building's roof. Her agoraphobia kicks in again, and Helen finds herself cornered. Accepting her fate, she turns to face Foley. However, just as he's about to kill her, MJ shoots him in the brachial nerve, giving him one last chance to surrender. When he pulls his gun back on her, however, she shoots him several more times until he dies. Sometime later, Daryl Lee Cullum writes a letter to another serial killer from prison, instructing them on how to kill Helen and revealing that he'd been aiding Peter Foley, the copycat killer, all along. Cullum wishes good luck to his new proxy in the mission of killing Helen and enacting his revenge. The film received positive reviews from critics when it came out in 1995. It holds a 76% rating on Rotten Tomatoes currently, but audiences polled by CinemaScore actually gave the film a grade of A- on an A+ to F scale, which I've heard is, in my experience, is actually pretty rare.
Yeah, I mean, I think so too, especially for a movie like this. And Roger Ebert gave it 3.5 stars, and the Siskel from the group gave it 2 thumbs up. They called Holly Hunter's character one of the most intriguing and three-dimensional characters of that particular year.
The film is actually recognized by, or almost recognized, I should say, by the American Film Institute in AFI's 100 Years, 100 Thrills. It was nominated for the top 100 thriller list.
Well, and this is of importance to you as well, because Christopher Young was nominated for a Saturn Award for his musical score.
Yes. And in fact, the score is actually fairly famous among film score nuts. Actually, James Newton Howard was approached to score the film, but turned it down to work on Waterworld, of all things.
Oh my god, I mean, talk about one of the biggest bombs in cinema history, right?
Yeah, well, Christopher Young replaced him, and John Amiel, the director, was so happy with the result he renewed his collaboration with Young on several other films.
I've seen this movie so many times in my life, from like the age 16 to now, and I never noticed the score, I think, because I was paying attention to so much else in the movie. But after you had told me in a previous conversation about the score, I really noticed it. And it adds a lot to the movie. I mean, it really helps, like, the feel of it, the intensity of certain scenes, and even just the quiet moments. There are certain parts of the score that I liken back to the score from Silence of the Lambs. And I know that a lot of people online or in any community often call this almost, I don't want to say a ripoff of Silence of the Lambs, but something that follows in that particular series of movies that came afterward.
Yeah, the music does kind of hearken a little bit to that, kind of a subsumed kind of, it does have a kind of 90s vibe, but he did actually go on to do some other really famous horror scores, my famous being like almost the definitive horror score, over the top as it is Drag Me to Hell.
Oh, did he really?
Yes, he did.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
The movie itself was made on a budget of $20 million, and it grossed $32 million. And, I mean, I haven't done any kind of, like, 90s math to know what that would be in today's standards, but, I mean, that's pretty sizable for a movie of this caliber.
Yeah, it's hard to actually know how successful that is, because there's always hidden marketing costs. And
I always assume that marketing is put into the budget they release, or is it not?
No, unfortunately, at least how they do it now. I've seen it where it matches, or it actually looks like it actually made something.
Yeah.
Like John Carter. It looked like it actually made some money, but they said no, it was like $100 million loss. And I was like, where did that $100 million come from? That's not in the budget. And apparently it's not put in the official budget, so the numbers look better.
I recently heard an interview on another podcast from a filmmaker. She made the movie Blockers that came out recently, and it was made for a really small amount of money. And they asked her directly, like, how much did you spend on marketing? And she said, it's about the cost of your budget. So you double your budget, and that's what, you know, includes the marketing. So, I mean, yep. $40 million is not quite that much of a loss.
Yeah, because technically marketing isn't making the movie.
And, I mean, it's been a long time since 1995, so I can't remember what kind of marketing this movie had. I saw it in the theater with my mother, of all things. And, like, we knew about it, of course, but this is the kind of movies that we like to watch anyway, so we were going to see it regardless. But mm-hmm. I think that $32 million for this particular movie, especially in October, when I'm sure they're releasing other, you know, horror films or something like that, is pretty good.
Okay. I'd like to talk a little bit more about John Amiel and what he's directed, because he's not really known for thrillers at all. In fact, before he directed this, he was mostly known for comedies, which I think is really interesting. He's directed at least, I think, 9 other films, including Summersby, Entrapment, The Core, and Creation, about Charles Darwin. His newest film, Deliverance Creek, came out in 2014. His range as a director is actually fairly impressive, having worked on a lot of genres, obviously the comedies, period drama, science fiction, disaster. He's also worked on several television shows, including The Borgias and 7 Seconds. The newest show we'll be working on is Carnival Row, which is on Amazon, which is going to star Orlando Bloom and Cara Delevingne.
Oh,
she's pretty. In 2019.
His name is not, like, on the tip of my tongue. In fact, I mean, I didn't know his name. I didn't know who directed this movie at all. I just assumed it was one of those random one-offs. I mean, one of the one-hit wonders that the 90s was so famous for, both in film, television, and music. I mean, the 90s really gave us people who gave one good movie, and then everything else just sort of faded off into the distance.
Sure, and no film was alike on his list. So,
no, and that's pretty amazing.
I'd like to know more about how he chose or was chosen for this film. Because he hadn't had anything in his repertoire to prove that he could do this. He created atmosphere. You know, maybe he just shot the script, but, I mean, and of course, those actors made this work.
Well, this cast
made this work.
To harken back to, I'm sorry, to Silence of the Lambs, too, I think Jonathan Demme, at his point in that career, had not made a movie like that either. I mean, so again, the similarities of this are sort of outstanding.
Yeah, and I don't know about budgets back then, but $20 million probably mostly to pay Sigourney Weaver.
Oh, yeah.
You know, was possibly still, like, it was pretty expensive, even for a horror movie, I would say, back then, but I could be wrong. I'd say it's on the expensive end for a genre piece.
Something tells me, too, that, I mean, like, Holly Hunter, by the time they made this movie, I mean, she wasn't near as well-known as Sigourney Weaver.
Well, I believe she had already been in The Piano, for which she had won
some awards. I was trying to think of which came first. Yeah, I mean, so she did win the Oscar for that movie, didn't she? Yeah. But I'm sure that Sigourney Weaver's price tag had to have been a little heftier. But I'm sure, I mean, like, if they were smart and they read this script, they would have taken a reduced salary to make this movie, I think. But we haven't really seen Holly Hunter in other genre films like this. Sigourney Weaver is not afraid to show up in a horror movie of any kind.
Yeah. The Piano came out in 1993, and she was also in The Firm in 1993. Both of those before Copycat.
God, I haven't seen The Firm in a long time either.
Yeah. So she was actually pretty fresh, and she would have been a pull along with Sigourney Weaver.
Well, by the time that Sigourney Weaver made this movie, she had already been nominated for a couple Academy Awards.
That's correct.
I mean, like 3 by this point.
Yeah.
So, and none of those were genre films. I mean, where was her accolades for Alien? I mean, come on. She spent all the end of that movie in some really skimpy squirrel covers, and I mean, where was her Oscar for that?
Squirrel covers.
I got it.
Send me some of your squirrel covers.
I beg your pardon?
I beg your pardon? Your panties. You wear them, don't you? That's what I want.
Jesus
Christ. Look, I want them autographed to me personally. Daryl Lee Cullum, deal?
That's a promise.
Your panties.
Oh, I hate that.
I would like to talk about how incredibly 90s this movie is. I mean, because there's been some passage of time. I saw it a lot when I was younger, and then after we had had a conversation about it, I watched it again, and it had to have been at least 10 or 12 years since I've seen this movie.
Sure.
And just watching some of the things in it, just it struck me as like some sort of 90s nostalgia for me on that particular day that I watched it. Things like the technology in Helen Hudson's apartment just seemed so incredibly 90s to me. And I mean, like, I just don't understand how she could have this entire setup when the rest of us was like watching AOL screens trying to know if we can like check our email.
Oh stuff. Yeah. There's a lot of 90s-isms. I remember there was one quote, he's hacked into her internet address. And I'm like, excuse me?
Can you even do that?
I mean, he sent her an email. So it literally just means he knew her email address. I mean, like, she opened a file, you know, and they're calling this AVI file a program. Can you run the program back? Oh, they wrote a virus, a self-destructing virus into
he's that clever bastard or whatever the hell.
It's a self-destructing AVI video file. Give me a break, right? But, you know, it's 90s and no one knew any better. I certainly didn't when I first watched this, and probably the second time I watched it.
No, because
I watched
course.
It around the time when it came out, and I was pretty young.
Yeah, I was 16 when this movie came out. And I mean, like, the internet was a thing, you know? I mean, not everyone had it in their own homes at that particular time. But there was no reason for me to, like, not accept everything that was going on, which is, like, back up to tape, you know?
Oh, back up the tape. That was the worst.
I was just like, well. All I know is I was like amazed that this killer could like make that little skull on legs and then turn around and jump off with an ass showing like it's Monty Python or whatever.
Yeah. Having done what I've done in animation, like all the stuff that they did in there was just so unrealistic, but it serves the film. And I don't think the vast majority of audiences would care and notice.
Well, I mean, like when I was 16, if I got an email and some girl was dancing around and her face turned into a skull, I'd probably shit my pants.
Oh, sure. I mean, because the sound of the internet back then was, you've got mail.
Right.
You know?
I'm like, oh my God. Also, I think in the 90s that there was such a huge, like, girl power movement. I know, and that sounds incredibly sexist. I mean, I don't know what you would call it today, but in the 90s, it's exactly what they called it. I mean, things like with the Spice Girls and in movies like Silence of the Lambs, bringing forward a very strong female character in a way that, you know, we weren't quite used to. Mm-hmm. And Copycat really did the same thing. I think that this movie has two women who are in fields that are probably very male dominated. And no one questions their abilities at all in this movie. Everyone looks at them as like the end all be all of who they are, a detective and a psychologist.
That's true. I feel like the only judgment that we get really from any of the main characters, even main side characters, is actually from MJ herself. She has some sort of like, she has an impatience with Helen. For her agoraphobia and her panic attacks and her anxiety, because she's trying to get Helen to help herself. She's trying to get Helen to help her with this case. And when Helen is not at 100%, she loses interest. And she almost serves like a member of the audience in a way. For those who don't know the effects of PTSD or chronic anxiety or panic attacks, they don't have the patience for it. They don't understand it. They think this is drama or petty woman bullshit when it's entirely not at all.
Well, coming from somebody who's never had a panic attack in their life, I mean, like, I obviously can't put my hands on what that would be. I can't wrap my head around it, in fact. But,
well, as someone that actually used to suffer from chronic anxiety and panic attacks, basically originating from PTSD, I can say that they did some hit or miss with the agoraphobia, because I actually nearly became agoraphobic. And the feeling she gets at the door, like a complete normalcy until she gets to the door having to walk out, it's almost like a physical barrier. And at that point, it's not about what caused it. It's not about necessarily Cullum, or being stalked by a serial killer. You know, 13 months later, it may just be about the fear itself. Agoraphobia almost feeds on itself in cycles. And so there was somewhat of a realistic approach to this, and it was actually handled with some respect. And I do have to give props to the writing or the directing for handling that. There was even different camera work to show her kind of dizzying, or just having a different effect, kind of bringing the audience in.
Okay, definitely. The cinematography for that is great. Because, I mean, the minute she walks into the hallway, you know, I mean, for a layperson, right, would know exactly that something is not right with her. I think that in the context of the film, though, you're right, it's really not about Cullum or that particular attack that did it. Because I think when she's giving that lecture at the beginning of the movie and she thinks that she sees Darley Cullum, I think that the look on her face and the look that she gives to the bodyguards and the fact that she even has bodyguards around her means that she already is a little nervous or a little anxious, right?
Sure.
And so maybe she's just predisposed to that kind of stuff anyway. And this is just what pushed her over the edge into complete agoraphobia.
And at that point, I get the feeling that she was kind of impatient with that, there may or may not be any evidence of this in the film, but I felt like there was, where she didn't really necessarily feel the need for that security as much. It might have just been, police or bodyguard kind of escort, where she was, you know, hey, this person has escaped.
Yeah.
They may be coming after you. Here's a police escort for your protection. Because when she's taken into that restroom at the lecture, after she gives her lecture, she doesn't seem too concerned at all. She's very casual and kind of blasé about dismissing the cop and saying, thanks, I can go pee now.
Right.
You know? But that actually brings us to an interesting point about the film itself, is that it's actually bookended by these restroom scenes. And they're probably the most, outside of some photography and some police work, they're probably most disturbing parts of the movie, if there's any disturbing part. And this is where she gets attacked by Cullum, who she helped to put away before based on her, expertise. And he comes to basically attack and kill her. Unfortunately, he doesn't dot all his I's and cross all his T's, and he doesn't realize a second cop is on the way.
I don't know where in the world he was in prison, but they have got to be like the worst place in the world to house a serial killer. I mean, clearly.
Yeah.
They should have kept some tabs on him.
Well, he at least escaped once, right?
Can I just say about Sigourney Weaver, too? I mean, like, and no disrespect to those who have had panic attacks and things like that. I mean, but outside of her crippling mental illness or, you know, phobia, she's like living my best life. I mean, she has this fantabulous apartment overlooking the bay. She wakes up and is drunk already. She spends all her time in chat rooms and playing chess and just, like, having a kiki with her, you know, gay assistant and whatnot. And I'm just like, that's perfect. Also, she hasn't left the house in 13 months and she's put on no pounds. I mean, that's just fucking ridiculous. She's living my best life.
Yes, yes, yes.
But if I can't get the newspaper out of the hallway, I guess it's all moot. I guess they didn't have newspapers on the internet back then. Or maybe she lost her dial-up at that one point. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well,
there's plenty of foreshadowing outside of the bookend of starting of that and ending with the bathroom scene as well. But we have this huge, like, hidden in plain sight theme going on in this film, where we can actually see the copycat killer, who is copycatting all of those killers at the request and possibly just tutelage of Cullum, who is writing to him, presumably in jail or in prison. And we see Peter Foley, the copycat killer, in basically all of the different crowd scenes. Like, he's there in the beginning. Mm-hmm. I actually thought he was gay at first, just because, like, in the first scene, like, you don't realize, if you watch this movie the first time, he's there. He's actually in the police station as they're trying to figure out the first three murders before Helen's even involved as an agoraphobe. You know, he's actually there in the crowd and he goes, hi.
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 Where they're trying to, like, that guy who's, like, falsely admitting to the murder, and they usher him out and he's like, oh, hi.
Yeah. Hi.
Oh, hi, copy.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So he's just standing there going, hi, for no reason. And, like, police just don't pay attention to him whatsoever. And he's in, like, a lot of the crime scenes that, you know, he's I don't know the exact number, but he's in several of them. He's of course in the beginning scene in the lecture. You can see him when she asks all of the straight white guys to stand up, and he's there standing up with everyone. He even shows up on the big screen.
Yeah, they pan to him twice in that particular shot. And she's actually like, the spotlight's on a different person, but he's standing directly behind him, just smiling into the camera like some fucking serial killer. And, I mean, did they look at the footage of that, too, at some point in the movie? They're like... She's like, oh, I have it on tape, clearly, because everything's back to tape.
And she had the transcript of her lecture, but she did not have a recording, it didn't seem like, and she did not have a video recording.
That's just the worst.
You know, I guess I don't know how much of a plot point that is.
She spent her budget on bodyguards and not on a videographer. That's exactly what it was.
And automatic window blinds.
My God. I mean, like, I'm telling you, my best life. That apartment is amazing.
Yeah, well, they came in handy, slightly, I guess. But yeah, he's in all of these crowd scenes, like except for a couple where you'd expect him. As soon as you expect him to be there, he is not there.
Anytime that the detective says, like when they show up to the final DeSalvo murder scene, where she realizes that the stocking's been taken off the neck, she tells that photographer go and like scan the crowd and take some pictures, right? And we never really see who's in that crowd except for the press. And then later on, when he's doing a Son of Sam killing, and Dr. Hudson tells Ruben, look in the crowd, because Son of Sam always came back to look, and he like pans the crowd, but he's not there. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's because right at that exact moment, he's coming to, you know, torture Helen in some way.
Yeah. So I want to talk about the performances in this film a little bit. I felt like Sigourney Weaver did an excellent job portraying agoraphobia, panic attack. It was a little dramatic here and there, but that it's not unrealistic in some of her portrayals. And I feel like she does a great job straddling between panic, anxiety, confidence, all of those things, angry. I mean, she's all over the place, and she does it while bringing a lot of dimension to this character. And you really kind of get her personality from the get-go, and you feel for her.
I agree. I mean, she comes across as hard-boiled, especially like giving her lecture period. She clearly is well-versed in her subjects, and she knows exactly what she's talking about. And when dealing with the police, especially these two detectives, she comes across as, I mean, somebody who necessarily doesn't want to be very helpful. But the minute that they are out of the house and it's just her and her assistant, she becomes this very almost demure woman who is like searching to have outside connections that aren't involved in a computer screen and almost hopeful that they'll come back. I think really, I mean, she might not have wanted to help these police officers, but she did it maybe just even for the human contact. And I mean, it's clear in her entire performance, that's exactly what she wants to do. She's trapped in her house, but she wants to get out. She wants to have the life that she had before that.
Yeah, and her assistant, Andy, even says, you know, live or die.
Exactly.
You know, do this work, or you just fall down and die, you know, and that's your choice, essentially. And she really sells it. Holly Hunter, on the other hand, actually does a lot of the, even though she doesn't have necessarily the meatiest role, she does a lot of the heavy lifting as far as performance is concerned. She does a lot of, there's a lot of long shots with her, at least one in particular, where she's going through the crime scene in the beginning, near the beginning of the film. And she has a lot of just body language and glances and how she interacts with other police and her partner and the media and everyone else. And there's just a really subtle performance. And actually, I think it was Roger Ebert that said it was one of the most, you know, most fleshed out performances that he'd seen.
Yeah, he said it was one of the most three-dimensional performances that year. Sure. And he's right. I mean, like, you know a good performance when you can easily get who that character is just based on, without even speaking, I mean, just their actions or their face. And that shot where she enters that apartment, and she immediately goes into cop mode. And it's right before that, she was making jokes in her car, and it's just this complete switch.
And she has a way with her voice and her body language and the way she...
Just the way she like, presents herself. Her face.
Yeah, she can present three or four different emotions at the same time, just effortlessly. And speaking to how the cast actually played off each other, I thought this film was nearly perfectly cast. And to the point where I'm actually wishing there was more... there were more films with Sigourney Weaver and Holly Hunter together, because they actually played very well off each other, if almost antagonistically. even Sigourney Weaver came back years later and said that she wished the film had done better or was remembered better because it is one of the her performances that she is most proud of.
I don't think that it's ill-remembered.
Well, I think it's just not remembered.
I mean, while doing some research for this movie, though, I read some reviews on Rotten Tomatoes. I read some reviews on Amazon, and they were mostly positive. And obviously, I don't know the age of the people who wrote these things. They could be our age or even older who are just looking back and remembering a movie fondly.
Right. And I think it was kind of dismissed. I think – I don't know that it was given poor reviews or not thought of well. I think it was just not remembered – because it was kind of dismissed for a Silence of the Lambs clone or something. And while it does have a lot of beats similar, and there's echoes of Silence of the Lambs, you can't deny it, it stands alone.
It does. So true crime is incredibly popular in the United States, especially now. It always has been, given things like Unsolved Mysteries and America's Most Wanted. People just always had a fascination with true crime and serial killers in general. And today, if we look at what's like currently popular, like top podcasts are all about true crime. We have the Oxygen Network, who used to be solely programming, you know, geared toward women, which has now rebranded itself as a true crime network. And I think today more than ever, people are just fascinated by serial killers and crime. And when you're talking about wishing to have more movies that had featured them, I see no reason why this couldn't have had a sequel at some point. I mean, it makes sense that they could easily continue it.
Yeah, like Copycat 2, squirrel covers.
Yes. Your panties.
Yeah, so apparently Harry Connick Jr. was asked by director Amiel to come up with a slang term for ladies' panties, and he's the one that came up with squirrel covers, which I guess is something he'd heard his brother-in-law use.
Well, let me tell you, my brother and I used to watch this movie a lot when we were younger. We had a VHS copy, and we watched it quite a bit, and that was his takeaway. I mean, as much as I took away from this movie, all he wanted to say was, squirrel covers, your panties, like over and over again. So well, he had an iconic line.
Oh, yes, definitely. Definitely iconic. And actually, I think that role is iconic because it's Harry Connick Jr. Yeah. And I don't think anyone expected him. He was only really known as a singer, and even then barely. This was his third film, but I think this is his largest role yet. And I don't think he's done a role anything like it since. And it always surprises me that this is Harry Connick Jr. You know, he's known as the crooner, you know, or he's the romantic lead, you know, or romantic interest. You know,
let's not forget Hope Floats, where Hope Sandra Floats. Bullock had to wait for her husband to come out of a coma and get back to Earth from space.
And Will and Grace.
The plot was. Oh, he also Will and Grace. You're right.
Yeah. He was Grace's husband.
Leo. Right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If they had a sequel. So let's say they remade the movie today. Right. Do you think it would be any good?
I think it could be if they got some good writing. It all depends on the script. And
what
about
a different cast, though? I mean, like,
no, I wouldn't watch it with a different cast. I don't want it remade. I want a sequel.
Yeah, I want a sequel too.
I want Sigourney Weaver and Holly Hunter and Harry Connick Jr. to come back and do something. I think that would be an amazing film.
I would watch a weekly series.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. Because the chemistry was amazing. I mean, like, you get the idea that these two women are incredibly different in their personal lives. And yet, by the end of the movie, you can almost see, like, a spark of a friendship. Right.
Oh, sure. And, you know, like you say, the episodic thing, it almost has that Dial in for Murder type of aspect where, you know, and that's a trope where they're actually having to kind of rely on someone who can't be at the scene, mm-hmm. you know, for information and help to solve these crimes.
I think what really like solidified their friendship for me in the movie was after Ruben is shot in the police station and MJ shows up and she sort of breaks the news to Helen. And Helen's like, please come inside. Please come inside. And MJ's like, no, I gotta go. I mean, it's just clear, again, too, to Sigourney Weaver's performance that she's just looking for, you know, companionship. And MJ is really, too.
And what did you think about the larger aspect, like, of Ruben's, her partner's death? Because he was not killed by the serial killer, the copycat killer, and he wasn't killed by the Harry Connick Jr. serial killer. He wasn't killed by any of those. He was killed by just, like, a random criminal at the police station.
Well, because, I mean, it goes to show you that, I mean, like, I mean, I don't, if they're going for some sort of like detective realism or something. I mean, these people have to show up to whatever homicide has been committed. And they're obviously working on something that's a serial killer, but they still have to go to what they always refer to in the movie as the Chinatown thing, right? And so you know it's going to show up eventually. I think that his particular death, the only purpose that it serves in the movie plot line-wise is to bring these two women together more fully.
Yeah.
He was always standing between them.
Yeah,
In a sense that they both wanted to bone him.
Well, I don't know that she did. I think she still had feelings for her ex or wasn't at all. I don't feel like I need to put like a romantic inclination on MJ's character at all. I feel like it's very subplot or sub-subplot.
Well, I think if anything, she felt more of a parent to him, right? I mean, as a way that only an older, more experienced detective would. Because he's getting a phone call and she's like, don't you want to know which one it is? Almost like teasing him. Yeah. Maybe she's almost like one of the boys or whatever.
Yeah, I felt like she felt like she was more of an older sister to him. I don't feel like there was a romantic loss at all there.
I mean, talk about a hard job, though. I mean, like, she shows up. She's, like, the only female detective in this San Francisco police station. Her boss calls her a broad repeatedly. And, I mean, she has to see her ex on a daily basis, who's not only, like, trying to get her to go back out with him, but, like...
And she deals with all of that so effortlessly.
Exactly.
And you can just tell how she does it. And how she just one-word answers to smooth things out. And mm-hmm. It's just... You could take lessons from this woman and have an easy life.
My favorite Holly Hunter line from this movie is when her ex is like, oh, is it something I did in a past life? And she just turns and is like, it's probably something you did in this one, and walks away. And I was just like, that's fantastic.
Mm. Well, I think Ruben dies, like you said, basically to give MJ and Helen a shared loss. It doesn't seem to cheapen his death, though. It kind of grounds the story in a way. Like there are other killers, other criminals, other problems and risks in the world besides, you know, our immediate problem of this serial killer. In the end, no one is safe, and death isolates both Helen and MJ for the film's climax, essentially. Especially since in the same 12-hour period, if not 6-hour period, mm-hmm. Andy dies, her assistant dies, because Peter Foley decides to do the Dahmer thing. Or the supposed Dahmer thing, and kill him. And essentially, they both lose someone very close to them within a very short amount of time. So it kind of isolates them, gives them shared loss, and lets the plot kind of move forward, focused, like laser focused on these two women.
Let's talk about Andy for a minute, shall we? Andy, the assistant. I like the fact that there's a gay character in this movie very much. Especially as a young gay boy of 16, you know, it's always good to go into a movie and see someone that you kind of want to relate to, whether or not you're out of the closet at that young age. But while looking on the internet about this movie, I came across an article put out by Logo, the television
sure.
channel, from 2008. And it was talking about the 8 worst depictions of gay characters in movies. And this particular one was on the list. And he says that once he heard that they were going to be copycatting Jeffrey Dahmer, he knew exactly why they created a gay character for this movie, because they needed a gay character for him to kill off in the style of Dahmer.
Yeah, it was almost too perfect for them not to do it that way. And this is actually fairly common as a trope, especially in the 90s and earlier. The trope itself is called bury your gays, basically meaning gays don't get a happy ending. You know, Andy ends up as one of Foley's victims, and it's only justified because Foley sought him out while copying Jeffrey Dahmer's M.O. But this is a trope that you see like over and over again in like older and newer movies like Atomic Blonde, A Single Man. But older ones too, like Braveheart, 4 Weddings and a Funeral, both Independence Day films, Watchmen. I mean, the list goes on and on. Gays don't get happy endings.
Well, I mean, I don't necessarily think... I mean, to call him one of the worst depictions of gay characters in movies, I think, is ridiculous. I mean, because given the 90s, you were either like the gay best friend who was giving romantic advice who was no boyfriend in sight. You
well,
know?
Everything, and, I cannot blame the writers for doing exactly what they did, because it fits multiple pieces like a puzzle.
Yeah.
You know, who's she going to feel comfortable with? A gay best friend, she's going to feel comfortable. That's the only man she's going to feel comfortable with. Someone that's not, you know, does not look at her with the male gaze in a traditional sense.
Yeah, I mean, you can't be locked up in a house with somebody like that. It's also San Francisco in the 90s. I mean, like, exactly. I just don't think that his character should be considered one of the worst. No. I've seen a lot of movies with worse gay characters than this one.
Oh, I completely agree. He is not stereotypical. In fact, I felt like it was one of the best and earliest, you know, good depictions of gay men that didn't say, oh, he's dying of AIDS, or he's flouncingly right. gay, or he is diseased and evil, or he is a sinner or something. They didn't kill him because of any of those. He was killed because he was her friend. He was killed because it was a great opportunity for the copycat serial killer to make an example, you know, to kill her friend in a way that would also check off that other box of his, which was to make a Dahmer killing.
Well, and true. I mean, but like, he could have killed any man to be Dahmer, gay or straight. You know, he just needed to follow something like a decapitation to make that happen. And I mean, you're right. It really was because that she is a friend of his, and it hit her hard that he killed him. There's no point in him being gay.
Yeah, in fact, I think that the Dahmer killing, like, he's fairly accurate, or there's an amalgam of killing, you know, to kind of interpret these different serial killers as a copycat. But what he does with Dahmer is probably the least successful and least realistic. Basically, he suffocates him in the back of a bar or behind in an alley. And then he pulls out the hacksaw or whatnot, and then presumably he is decapitated off camera, and then his headless body is found washing ashore the next
Which
day.
Which is nothing like Dahmer would have done.
No, it'd be in a fridge somewhere, and he'd right. be, you know, doing nice, wonderful things with the body parts.
Because that's what he wanted to do, you know? And so, I mean, and it would have been a little bit more fitting, and maybe you could have said they made him gay only to, like, serve the Dahmer role if he had, like, actually been a gay serial killer himself, you know? Yeah,
the fact that Peter wasn't gay may have interpreted that, but I also wonder if it's the writers and the or studio or all of this to where it was kind of brushed over, you know, and kind of just not done very well or realistically, or it was kind of half-assed by the copycat killer, either because he was gay or the writers just weren't comfortable with this, because remember, this is 1995.
It's not going to play in Midwest America.
Exactly.
Yeah, I know. Right. I mean, and there were inconsistencies all through this movie to begin with anyway, not just the Dahmer-style killing, but the killing itself of Son of Sam was nothing like anything that David Berkowitz ever did. He shot people in cars, but the writer clearly used situational aspects of all these serial killers to fit his particular story. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning, though, some of like DeSalvo and Hillside Stranglers were almost on the mark. But I mean, some of these things at the end is just really trying to help us toward the end of the movie itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, but I would have Andy be my assistant any day of the week. He cared about her. His bed was always made, probably because she was looking for him. Well, maybe he's not the best assistant, because every time she was looking for him, he's not there.
She's Andy! Like,
and then she goes to his room, and his bed's not even slept in. And again, it's San Francisco, and he's a gay man in the 90s, so he's out doing something else. Maybe he just goes out too many times and gets a roofie colada at the end, and it's bad.
Maybe he's just going to the library.
Is there no closet in this magnificent apartment?
Well, let's talk about another thing. There's a subplot where, you know, MJ is actually, you know, kind of tutoring her new rookie partner about how to shoot bad guys. And so she tells him to shoot him in the brachial nerve in the shoulder. And that kind of comes back to haunt her a couple times. So when he's killed, essentially, in the middle of the film, or near the end, I should actually say, she shoots his assailant, who's holding him with a gun to his head, in the shoulder, getting the brachial nerve, which is great, but then they just use their other arm and shoot him to death. So she learns a lesson there, and then at the end again, when she is saving Helen from Peter Foley, the copycat killer, she shoots him the brachial nerve. Essentially, you know, she needs to give up. He lunges towards her, she finally shoots him multiple rounds in the chest, he still doesn't stop, she shoots him in the head, he dies instantly.
Well, in both of these particular situations, the really clearest shot she had in the first place was the brachial nerve, right? She couldn't pummel him with bullets because Helen's standing right in front of them.
Well, I think
Reuben in the other situation.
It's just that there's three beats. There's the beginning, the middle, and the end almost exactly. bookended and in the center with this you've got to just shoot to kill. You've got to shoot these guys to kill. And that's kind of like the final thought for that. I don't know why they kept bringing that beat in. I guess the best stories rhyme, but she finally learns her lesson and shoots him in the freaking head.
Well, at that point she had to. I think first and foremost MJ is a cop, and I don't think that she wants anyone to die. And no matter what particular crimes that they have committed, I think for her probably the best justice is court justice, and getting them to that final place is what she wants to do. I think that she learned a lesson from Reuben dying. And that's why she's so quick to shoot Peter Foley in the head at the end of the movie. Well, also, he's coming at her again. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I think horror movies have taught us nothing if you should just make sure that person is dead completely.
Well, that brings up an interesting point where she wants to bring him through the process, right? And what's interesting is that this is not a real serial killer. Serial killers, you know, they get off on the hunt and the stalking and the almost ritualistic, habitual planning and, aspect of it. At the same time, this guy's different. He is taking instruction, as we find out, from Colum, who's in prison. And his goal is not to kill people. His goal is to become famous as a killer. Mm-hmm. He doesn't really care. He's just following a recipe that other people have written down, essentially.
Because he has got the worst life ever. I mean, like, I don't know what he does for a living, but it's clearly something technical. He's got enough spare time to hang around.
No, he worked at a sperm bank.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
And, I mean, his wife is, like, just awful, you know?
I thought, for the longest time, the first few times I watched this movie, I thought it was his mother.
Oh, really?
She seems obviously older than him.
I think he just married somebody he didn't want to be married to, someone who can't watch talk shows by herself, and, I mean, like, demands a goodnight kiss.
Yeah, that whole thing seemed interesting. And in the end, he shot her in the face, and she's, you kind of see it in a quick scene when they kind of rush his house, and he had preset it to, burst into flames and kind of explode. I thought he was going to, like, blow it up on the cops, but apparently they...
No, he just wanted his wife to die.
But if, as I think Helen says, if he wants to be famous, he has to be caught.
It does.
He's sending you letters like he's daring us to nail him.
If he wants to be famous, he has to be caught.
Yeah, and they do. I mean, and that's just actual serial killer 101, is that if they want to be famous, they have to get caught. That's why so many killers like taunt the police with letters and things like that, things that he was doing. He was copycatting letters that other killers have done, but he definitely wanted to get caught. Mm-hmm. I think at the end of the day, he would have killed MJ and killed Helen and gotten caught by whatever cops came in later, and that's what have brought him his fame. And also, Daryl Lee would have been happy because Helen was dead.
Yeah, I think he would have just killed everyone and stayed there and waited for the cops to show up to arrest him.
Because he's not a serial killer. Helen said during her lecture that she was talking about the hot guys that are standing up, and she's like, what gets you off? A pair of legs or whatever. And she's like, what gets a serial killer off is the pain and devastation of another human being. And I was just like, well, that's true. So, I mean,
yeah. There's a lot of tension in this movie that builds. And one of my favorite lines at the height of that tension, after Helen's gotten her apartment broken into several times, she's seen the intruder. Finally, she gets Fingor. Meaning, the fingers hidden in her bed that have been,
always getting the finger
ripped off or whatever. And there's all those ants. Like, did she just already have those ants? Did he bring those in separately? Like, what's going on?
I mean, maybe he left the book outside for a little bit while he was trying to break in, and he had to go back and get it.
So anyway, it's in there. And basically, of course she calls the cops after she finds that, of course. And MJ basically tells her the man in your apartment is the same one who's killed 5 women in the city, mm-hmm. And basically goes on and explains, how is she going to deal with this?
The man who has killed 5 women in the city was just in your apartment.
What I don't like in that particular scene is that red, skirt suit that she has, right? Yeah. She was, almost killed in a bathroom wearing that. Why is it still in her fucking closet?
Well, because I don't think that she associates the clothes she was wearing with it. It wasn't special.
She remembers it when it's laying on her bed, though.
Right.
Either way, a good cop would have made that evidence.
Because if that was true, then yeah, I would have... burn that outfit.
For real. It's like, I've already had 15 brandies and a handful of pills today. I'm going to take a shower. And she lays something out on the bed. I mean, and who does that anyway? And then she comes back and it's that red suit. And she even herself, she's like, well, I don't know if I pulled it out of the closet. And I'm like, bitch. Like, first of all, get rid of that fucking thing. And secondly, like, how many of those do you have if you're not even sure you pulled that out of the closet or not?
Mm-hmm. So there's a couple of actual interesting facts about the making of this movie. In earlier versions of the script, MJ, played by Holly Hunter, was actually written as a man and had a romance written in for between MJ's character and Helen.
Oh, God.
And I'm so glad they didn't do that. And I'm tired of hearing, oh, this person was actually written for a man. That's why it's such a strong female character. I hate that.
That's terrible.
I know, but in here, and it generally actually works out well. You write them as a person,
mm-hmm.
you know, you write them ungendered or gendered, you know, but generally it works out well, especially in Holly Hunter's case here. And I'm sure they made a few changes.
Well, why couldn't they still have a relationship anyway? I mean, she's already been burned by her ex and Ruben's dead. Isn't the next logical step Helen? I mean...
Also, in the climactic bathroom reenactment scene with the copycat trying to do what Colm did to her, Sigourney Weaver spat in William McNamara's face without his prior knowledge from her first So his reaction of anger and shock was actually pretty real. And it's actually long.
The actual stab wound that Sigourney Weaver was inflicted with.
No, you can see, it's like it takes a good 5 or 10 second reaction shot from him where he's like, what just happened?
Oh, I just How thought he was happening? Being a really good actor.
And you kind of just like look on his face. The look on his face says, excuse me, bitch.
Yeah, I should have been stabbed right then.
Yeah, and he didn't want to because he wanted to kill her in a very specific way, actually brings me to her power here. Because what I think like really kind of, he's a step ahead all through this movie. Like he's in control. And he's basically learning from all the mistakes, you know, from the previous serial killers, including Colm, by putting the motion detector in the hallway, knowing mm-hmm. if someone's coming or not. And essentially, he's setting it all up and it's flawless. But she's up hanging over, just basically barely balancing, being essentially hung over a toilet and basically just holding herself up by her toes, you know, just as happened at the beginning of the film with Colm. And he's basically saying, watch me kill this cop here. Just watch me do it.
Shoot it.
You have to
stick it.
Yeah. Yeah. How am I, because she has to as part of the role. And she says, I have power here. She realizes. She closes her eyes, first of all, because mm-hmm. he's asking her to watch. She doesn't have to watch. And then she basically tries, or I don't know if she really, she probably doesn't care at that point, but she basically decides to make it seem as though she is killing herself. She takes her feet off and she is essentially hanging herself. And so she's taken back the power of the situation and he has to shoot the attachment off this hanger, you know, this thing hanging her. And she falls, you know, and he has to basically take the strap off. You know, she's back in control. She manages to stab him with a piece of glass and escape. And that's what that really puts the power back in. And she, you know, that's his end. You know, by that time, MJ, Holly Hunter's character, comes back to life for whatever because she was just shot in the shoulder.
And she was...
Literally just shot in the shoulder. And there we go again. And and she's able to shoot our guy on the roof again in the Brachylander.
I mean, a real serial killer, though. I know he wanted to recreate everything, and that's the whole point of the movie, is careful recreation. And if his ultimate goal was for her to die, you know, I think that he could have killed MJ, and she would have heard it. First of all, whether she saw it or not, and then she's dead, and his ultimate goal would have been completed. I think that he's got, you know, some hubris or something going on that he's got to kill her himself. So maybe he is a serial killer after all. I mean, if the whole point was to get famous, maybe by the end of it, he really wanted to kill that woman himself.
Well, at the very least, he seemed OCD about the way he did these things.
I'm sure he was OCD.
They needed to be exact. And in fact, the things that are different are actually notable because he, instead of hiding or, you know, he actually pretended to be a dead cop when MJ went in there to, you know, save Helen. And Helen can't tell her where the guy is, because the guy would just kill her. He told her, if you tell her where I am, I will kill her.
Daryl did some pretending of his own too, and he's in that stall.
Yeah, that's true. However, he lays down there and pretends he's, you know, he's the dead cop. We've seen that before. We've seen that in Silence of the Lambs, and we've seen that in Saw. So it's a trope of its own. But it's interesting that if this guy is so serious about copycatting other serial killers, obviously he's serious enough to copycat fictitious ones as well.
Oh, clearly. I mean, maybe he would have been a really good screenwriter eventually.
But that's just one of quite a few references or call-outs, I would say, to Silence of the Lambs.
I think there's a lot of references in this movie to past cinema. Watching it, I get a lot of Brian De Palma from it, and some of his, like, noir horror movies that he makes, and obviously Jonathan Demme's Silence of the Lambs is all the way through this. But I think that it really does pay homage to some sort of Hitchcockian past of horror movies, right? Or way back to the beginnings of slasher films, before they were just like completely overtly gory and violent, right? Things like Psycho. And I mean, it just really is sort of almost like a love story to a crime thriller.
Yes.
Which I think brings us to another point. Can we call this a horror movie?
I think we can.
I think so. I mean, why would you call it a horror movie?
Well, I would call it a horror movie because I believe thriller and suspense and basically anything that's in the macabre or tries to scare or thrill or basically frighten you or bring you to that space, that kind of dark space. In nonfiction, fiction, fantasy, I would say all of that is either under the horror umbrella or at least kind of Venn diagrammed into it. And I would certainly say this is kind of slasher adjacent, which is definitely considered horror. Yeah,
I mean, like, slasher is one of my favorite subgenres of horror. And I really think that this movie is sort of a slasher movie in disguise. I think we have all the basic elements of it. We have mostly women getting killed by a mostly unseen murderer in the first part of the movie. And I think it's not until we actually know the killer's face that it sort of becomes something that's not a horror movie, that it becomes a crime drama or a crime suspense movie. Once we know who the killer is, it's more about bringing him to an end than it is about the actual murders that he's committing.
Sure.
But I think just because you don't have the actual murder being committed on camera doesn't make it any less scary. So, I mean, were you scared in this movie?
I think I was. I don't remember anymore. I don't really get scared in films anymore.
It's very rare that I do, but I mean, it happens from time
to
time.
But I get creeped out, and that's one of those things that there's another kind of trope called nothing is scarier. And that nothing is scarier trope has to do with when nothing happens. Mm-hmm. And it's those moments of silence or not knowing, you know, or build up. It's that tension. And those are the thrillers and the suspense. And all of that is in the DNA of these types of movies. And it's done very well here. And I still do. Well, I don't do the jump scares. I don't get really scared by that. But anything that kind of builds up and takes its time with the tension, especially on a first watch, I can definitely feel that. And you can, and in some of these scenes, you can cut the atmosphere with a knife. Do a super job at building up the tension of, you know, where is he? What is he doing? You know, is he after them? Is he after me? Like, is this Cullum? Is this someone copycatting all these other serial killers? Are they related? Like, what's happening?
And I remember the first time I saw it, being on the edge of my seat, sort of. I mean, like I said, I love this movie from the moment that I saw it. It really fits into my wheelhouse in so many ways because I love true crime so much. I knew who all these killers were before even watching this movie at a young age. And I mean, whether or not that makes me sound like a complete psychopath is another question. But watching this movie, I can put myself in their particular situation, or even thinking back to what it must have been like living during the times of these serial killers, when we have like Son of Sam terrorizing New York, and how that must have felt living in that city. And there's nothing scarier, if you want to call that a trope, than real life, period, right? Sure. There's nothing supernatural in this movie, and all of it could very easily take place.
And that's another thing that actually kind of separates it from Silence of the Lambs, where Silence of the Lambs is completely fictional characters. This is, Copycat actually has a lot of real references to real crimes, real serial killers, and a lot of those play out on screen.
Well, Buffalo Bill was sort of modeled after a serial killer, but I mean, he was his own character, though, and that's the thing, is he was creating his own particular serial killer, and this person was just like doing stuff from the past.
Well, and the whole film kind of calls out and is familiar with Silence of the Lambs, but I feel like they're kind of separate but equal in a way, because Copycat in a way is much more personal. The protagonist in Silence of the Lambs, Jodie Foster, is never really an intended victim or a plaything. In a way, she is, but she's actually getting assisted by the, you know, Hannibal Lecter.
If she was a plaything, it was his plaything, and yeah, he was behind bars.
Exactly. Yeah. And but here, you know, Helen can be killed at any time. Anyone can be killed at any time.
It's true.
And not just by a serial killer.
And we know that's true because Reuben gets it.
Yeah. And a lot of the crimes we see are representations of crimes that really did happen in the real world,
which makes it even more unsettling. And most of the people who died, we didn't even know. We don't know their names in the movie. They weren't characters.
Sure.
Disposable people.
Another interesting fact was, like, an earlier version of the script had a finale in which Peter Foley kidnaps Helen and places her in the auditorium instead of the bathroom, where he gives her a lecture, complete with a slide projector, and reveals himself as a former student. The final film actually kind of implies, or at least subtly implies, that he might be a former or current student. I mean, he's certainly attending the lecture.
Oh, yeah. You know what? I didn't think about that, because he was writing to Cullum while Cullum was in jail.
Exactly.
Right? And so he's already there.
So presumably Peter Foley was in touch with Cullum before he escaped, and might have even aided and abetted him, or stayed with him or something during that time when he was after Helen.
Maybe they stopped and had a brief conversation before he was on his way to the bathroom in those heels.
An original ending was shot and shown to test audiences where Inspector MJ Monahan, of course Holly Hunter, was kidnapped instead of Helen Hudson. By Peter Foley, of course, the Copycat killer, and taken to the school for Helen to rescue. Obviously, this didn't play well because of Helen's agoraphobia, so, of course, it was kept with the original ending. I'm super glad they didn't do this, although it would have been kind of like, oh, I'm getting over it, but that wouldn't have made sense, because just agoraphobia doesn't work like that.
Well, and that's an unbelievable character arc anyway. Not to mention, we spend a lot of, I mean, it's clear in this movie that Helen Hudson is the main character, right? I mean, she has to overcome adversity to reach her end conclusion, which a lot of main characters have to do. And while we like MJ, I think we like most of the characters in this movie, even her asshole ex-boyfriend, right? I think we like these people, but we especially like Helen Hudson. And to see her put in a situation that she has to get out of or overcome things with is just a much better payoff than the detective who has to defend herself daily. You know, I just, it's not quite as satisfying to me. And I think that particular, either one of those endings would have been just subpar. I don't want to see the killer reveal himself to Helen giving a lecture. I'd rather hear another lecture of Helen's. I mean, while he could call himself a former student, and maybe it's implied, why would he want to kill her? I mean, did she give him an F or something? Did he not pass
the scores? I'd like to see that slideshow. I'd like to see what was in there, but I'd like to see.
Or maybe he's like, I paid so much attention to your work that you're the one who made me want to copycat these serial killers or whatever.
I'd like to see it in the bonus content of a DVD.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
I mean, to see what these characters want to done with that particular thing. If it tested poorly, that means they shot it.
Yeah, you know, that's true. It's out there.
Gotta be there somewhere. The makers of Copycat, if you're listening to this and you have this footage, could you please email it to us? We'd be greatly appreciative. Speaking of Helen's lecture in that auditorium, I want to bring up the fact that she does something in a horror movie that I always do when I watch one. And that is, she starts to pick out the most attractive men in it. She tells all these men to stand up in this auditorium and to tell the women to ogle them.
Now, I'd like to ask you guys a favor. If you could all please stand up. All the gentlemen in the room, please indulge me for a second. Come on, it's only fair after all the time you spent ogling us.
As somebody who's loved horror movies all his lives, most of the people that I talk to about these sort of things are always talking about the women in horror movies. And as a gay man, I'm looking at the opposite gender. So I want to talk for a minute about some of the hottest guys in this movie and who I think could be the possibly hottest. In Copycat, I have narrowed it down to three. Harry Connick Jr. himself is by far one of the most attractive men in Hollywood. I mean, he's aged perfectly, and at the time he was making these movies, with his, like, crooner background, I thought that he was incredibly hot, especially as a 16-year-old. The thing is, in this movie, they went leaps and bounds to make him look as unattractive and, like, batshit crazy as possible.
Oh, yeah, he's got the teeth in, and he's got the weird circle. I mean, he's got a lot going on that makes him
look. Well, he's got that hideous hair, and I love to spot a terrible wig in movies, and he just, like, looks bad.
I think that's his real hair. I think they just dyed it, like, dark red or something.
Please do not destroy Harry Connick Jr. any more than this movie already did for me. However, I will say that as crazy as he looked, I still would have a conversation.
Most of his ugliness was his acting. I mean, he did a great job at just acting like a freaking dumb hick. But he did it in such a way with his eyes that you knew he was smarter, and at the very end sequence before credits roll, he is talking out loud, reading his letter out loud that he's writing someone who basically instructed them how to kill Helen for him. And so we learn.
He may be stupid in real life, but he's a smart killer.
Yeah.
Except he got caught.
He's somewhat redeemed by his intelligence, but at the same time, he's not. So I think he's potentially the hottest, but unfortunately, within the context of the film, he is fairly ugly.
Right. Let's move on to Dermot Mulroney, who plays Reuben Goetz, MJ's playboy partner.
Doomed to die.
As all the really attractive ones are in cinema.
And of course, he went on to play in My Best Friend's Wedding as the best friend of Julia Roberts.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I know him from.
He pops up randomly. He's one of those actors that are always working. And I think that he was cast in this role solely because of his looks. I think they were meant to have this attractive man playing this role.
Yeah, I think that's one of his earliest roles. Because I actually watched an interview with Sigourney Weaver, and she actually specifically called him out as kind of an up-and-comer. And she was actually very proud of his performance.
And I think, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people were surprised at it, too. Because he was probably just hired for a face, because that's the way that character happened to be written, right? He was written as some sort of playboy that everyone wanted to sleep with. Even Andy, the gay assistant, was like, oh, yeah, he's cute, and he's probably coming back, so you might want to take that bag off your head kind of thing. And, I mean, everyone talks about how he looks. And he was a really hot guy. I mean, flat out.
Sure.
But he's still not the hottest in this movie.
Let's talk about William McNamara.
Let's do that. From the very first moment that we see this crazy serial killer lurking in the background saying hi to the cop, he's just hot. I mean, like,
hi.
Honestly, I didn't really notice him the first viewing of this movie in the crowd of the lecture. It wasn't until previous viewings of the movie that I saw that he was there. But when he goes upstairs to kiss his wife or mother, whoever that character happens to be, goodnight, and he goes back down to the woman that he's torturing on his table in the basement and cuts that slit in the bag that's over her head, and he was just like, I told you I'd take care of you. And I was like, well, by God, take care of me.
God, no.
And when he's sauntering over to Andy the assistant, carrying that roofie colada in that bar, I'm like, we could just buy me a drink. I mean, my God. clearly, he is the hottest guy in this movie. Unfortunately, William McNamara's career is not that illustrious.
No, it looks like he's mostly a TV actor, although that's not a bad thing. But
he did a lot of TV.
It looks like he works a lot.
He gets a lot of work now, but as far as movies go, he was in a movie called Chasers, which my brother liked quite a bit when we were younger, but it's all about, like, two people escorting some, like, criminal who happens to be a crazy attractive blonde lady. I mean, it's just not a movie that was geared toward me. Mm-hmm. So, would you watch Copycat again?
Oh, I would totally watch Copycat again, and I would recommend it for anyone who likes thrillers or horror adjacent, or anyone that is a fan of Holly Hunter or Sigourney Weaver, or just a fan of a good, well-paced, well-made, atmospheric movie.
Let's just say if you're listening to this podcast or if you tell someone about it, just go watch Copycat. It's a great movie.
Sure.
And we're all looking forward to the sequel.
Yes, the inevitable sequel that will never happen.
That we're going to start writing as soon as we stop recording this.
Yes, we're going to start writing.
Okay, well, thanks, guys, for listening to our podcast. Feel free to rate, review, and subscribe to it on wherever you get your podcasts. If you have any comments or questions, feel free to email us. Chris, what's our email address?
It's tiredqueens@filmflamers.com.
I am tired. You can also find us on social media like Twitter and Facebook at The Film Flamers.
Also, you can check out our website at filmflamers.com, which has links to all of our stuff, including social media, our store, and our Patreon page if you'd like to support our podcast.
Join us next month. We'll be talking about Argento's classic Suspiria, getting our conversations about it out 2 months before the remake.
Yay.
Until then, sweet dreams. That sounded really gay, didn't it?
It really did.
Well, that's good. We're the Film Flamers.